It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Michael Bailey. Joe may still be ill, we're not sure, but he was due to be off, so that's why I'm here. We have with us John McKenzie. Hello, John.
Hello, Michael Bailey.
We also have JJ Bull. Hello, Joe. JJ.
Oh, John. Yeah, it's hot in here, isn't it? Your brain's frazzled now.
It is, really.
We've been talking for a long time.
We've been talking about a long time talking of stuff. And the stuff we spoke about with the talking was Manchester City drawing at Nottingham Forest and how in a parallel universe somewhere they won this game. Or maybe they also lost it. Who knows?
They did both.
All of it. All the results, all of the time. The children's book, Flat Stanley, is also in there, along with Newcastle losing at Liverpool and having goalie troubles ahead of the League Cup final and a medal twist. Remote viewing and how it's complete garbage and not looking into the future. Oh, Chelsea, Graham Potter. Yeah, that's all going very well. Does he have too much of a supply teacher energy to succeed ever in
life?
Oh,
that sounds really harsh and not what I meant at all. Yeah.
In the words of JJ Bull.
Yeah. No. Don't clip this bit. That's not it. That's not what I mean.
Okay. And Barcelona, who are storming La Liga. And if you want to know even more about Barcelona, you should get The Athletic, where there is loads of Barcelona, isn't there, John?
There is, yes. I did a pronunciation guide with some of our Barcelona writers recently, so I'm really going to have to nail the pronunciation of Laia Cervera Herrera's name. Beautiful. That was all right, wasn't it?
That's great. Herrera.
Yeah. Paul Ballas, much easier to say. And I think this is an Irish name. I don't think it's Spanish. Dermot Corrigan. But excellent, excellent Barca coverage.
There you go. Get The Athletic. Should we say that?
Yeah. And if you go to theathletic.com/TIFO, T-I-F-O, you'll get a free trial for 30 days, of which you can read it. And if you don't like it, you can just get it the hell out of there.
That's theathletic.com/TIFO.
These guys bailing me out. Get ready for another hour of that to come. But at this point, I will leave you in the warm hands.
Cool hands.
Cool hands, warm embrace.
Warm hands.
Cool embrace.
Do it the other way around, right? Make it your thing. The warm hands and the cool embrace.
Do whatever you want.
Allow me to leave you in the chilly breeze of Steve Hankles. Only one place to start today, which is at Villa Park, where Arsenal won, having lost lots before, including to Manchester City. That was a really big defeat. But now that Arsenal have won, everything's fine again. They're back on top of the league. Everything's great. John, what did you make of Arsenal? It's all out. You know, they're back. They're going to win it. Everything's fine.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because that game, I feel as though, was a game that Arsenal deserved to win, but also didn't deserve to win at the same time, depending on at what point in the game you looked at it. Obviously, scoring a couple of goals in injury time is a nice way to get the win. And they did enough in the game to generate chances to win. But yeah, the same sorts of fragilities that we started to see creeping in with Arsenal. I think two goals from not a huge amount of attacking impetus from Villa, a couple of nice goals in transition. Thomas Partey not being in, obviously, plays that role of making sure that those sorts of goals aren't scored, and two of those goals were scored from not a particularly aggressive Villa side, I didn't think. I thought Villa were quite poor, but at the same time, it is worth saying that Arsenal did very well to get back. When your goal's down, it's always hard to come back into games, and they show that, especially when you're in a bit of a negative run. And yeah, we were saying just before we started this, like, it's interesting because I feel as though this game doesn't give any credence to the idea that Arsenal are suddenly out of their slump. But that kind of momentum that you get from winning a game at the death and then your rivals dropping points could be enough to get things going in the right direction again as well. So yeah, lots of ifs, maybes, could be's in the football this weekend. Things could have been very different at the end of the weekend. We could have seen Arsenal drop points and maybe City not drop points, in which case, yeah, we would be having a very different conversation today. But this is football, right? This is how it goes.
I think some people thought that Arsenal would probably just crumble a little bit. Some people, not me, obviously, I thought they'd be absolutely fine. But achieving that win from that situation strikes me as the sort of thing that successful teams do, JJ. The ones who win things, that's what they do. They pull that out of the fire.
This game just shows how stupid football is, right?
Because excellent.
At 2-2, or even at 2-1 for most of it, whatever, and then you're thinking, oh, Arsenal have capitulated. They've bottled it. That's the narrative. And then you get all videos on places like, I don't know, Tifo. And then things is doing things like, oh, Arsenal are too predictable. They've been sussed out. You know what's wrong with them. Every team knows how they play, and they do. But they are able to get over it because they've played well with it. And then because they score two goals in injury time, it's changed and they are real mentality monsters and they've come through and now they're back on top and in control of it. And there is truth in all different versions of what this game is. That's the thing. Like they were fine. They conceded two goals. The second, like what are you saying about Jorginho versus Partey, was that the ball went through Jorginho's legs. Maybe Partey would have stopped that for the goal.
No, I don't.
You would snap earlier on.
Yeah, I have been on record saying that, you know, you can't necessarily just say if you shove another player into a position, none of these goals would happen. But again, all I think you can say in these situations is goals were scored with Arsenal transitioning backwards. And that is an area where I think they've been quite strong this
season. There's a certain lack of speed and difference between Jorginho and Partey.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Partey would be a bit slightly more early to snap onto something and maybe stop it as well. I think, they're all right. Like Trossard's come in for Martinelli because Martinelli looks a bit tired. He's getting taken off quite often, not producing as much as he was before. You've got Benjamin White, as he likes to be known. Yes.
Benny Blanco to his pals.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Blanco, yeah, Ben Blanco at right back. And he he's been getting substituted for Tomiyasu quite a lot recently. And Tomiyasu even started against, was it Man City he started against?
Yeah.
So the players...
We saw that back pass.
Oh, yes, that's the one. But I mean, that was just unfortunate. Like Arteta said, he's worked with Tomiyasu for a long time. He's never seen him make that pass ever in training. If you're then every single day in training and you don't see it, it's just unfortunate. But then you've got just players who may be playing together an awful lot. They play in the same way. They're trying to adapt it a little bit now and again and tweak things. But if it works, then it works. And they're a little bit like Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool were in that regard. Like what they're doing was working really well. So why change it? The reason you would change it is because everyone's figured it out and they know ways to stop it. But if you're good enough, which Arsenal are, you can get by. And that's the difference that you'll have. And then you'll see if there's any more slight tweaks from Arteta with things you do going forward. But you can't really do that because the players he's got function perfectly as what they're doing. So then it might be you have different options on the bench like Manchester City do, so they can change the way they do things. There was a video I saw this week of Guardiola, whether he's being real or not, talking about how if he wants to build down the left, he'll play Laporte. If he wants to have runners in midfield, he'll play Gundogan and Foden, something like that, because you've got different options, different players make you play in different ways. You can't simply just make players do things you want them to do because certain players suit different situations, which is why certain managers will manage teams in different ways because they have different players. And Arsenal are good. But my original point was that because the score is 4-2, you think Arsenal have really come forward and they're champions in waiting now because they've overcome this. In actual fact, they're still clearly, like, they don't want to have conceded what they did. The goals weren't great. They can work on that in training. But had it gone a different way, the mentality might be totally different and it might have changed them psychologically going into their next game. So it's very important they've won, obviously, but then all games are important to win.
The concept of, like, Arsenal becoming predictable is quite interesting because we've talked a lot on this channel about how one of the strengths of Arsenal at the moment is that they have a lots of ways of being able to problem solve. But actually, if you break down Arsenal's approach, it's roughly the same all the time, right? So they can build up with different shapes. They can have a back three, one of their fullbacks moving out, making the back four into a back three, and then they can have two midfielders in front of them, or they can, you know, you can have one of your fullbacks pushing down the line. They have all of these sorts of solutions that allow them to get through teams as they press them, etc. And in every phase of play, they have that level of flexibility. But when you actually break down the system, it is roughly the same sort of system with roughly the same sort of players. And JJ makes the point that, you know, there was a couple of changes made in recent games, and that hasn't necessarily benefited them. So I think there's a couple of things that are going on. One is that they've been able to rely on largely the same starting 11 when they've needed to. And the other one is that, yeah, there is now a sense in which in the second half of the season, we're going to start seeing teams with solutions to some of the problems that Arsenal face. So actually, I think the three games that where they dropped points in a row were quite interesting, because the first one was Everton, Sean Dyche's Everton. And Everton did really interesting things in the midfield area. They played a mid-block with a really flexible rotation to stop space opening up in the middle, which is something that Arsenal are really good at doing, opening up space by getting teams to step forward to them and then exploiting that space. We then saw Brentford, who played the classic, let's sit deep, absorb pressure, try and hit them on the break. And they didn't have solutions for that as well. And then they had Man City, who obviously one of the best teams in the world, and beat them playing their own style of play as well. So I think what's interesting for me is that we've now seen Arsenal come up against a number of different teams who've caused them problems in different ways. And what the Premier League is just an unforgiving league. They have the best tactical minds in the analysis departments. They have the best managers in the dugouts, and they also have the most talented players who are able to solve those problems as well. So this is going to be the challenge for Arsenal now, I think. We can talk about momentum all we want, and obviously momentum is important, but I think the big question is going to be, how do they respond when they come up against teams like Everton, who think of a really good approach to cause them problems in certain phases of their play? How do they get around those problems? Is the fact that they only have like a very sort of one-dimensional flexibility within the same system going to be enough?
The other thing that I thought was relevant is that in terms of the different teams they finished that they've dropped points to, like the tactical stuff going on, whatever, and where they've dropped it, is also the psychological difference. What am I trying to say? Delete all this bit and start again. So the games they lost that John just touched on, Everton had that unique thing with a new manager, a different style of play, who was obviously going to put that thing in, galvanise the home fans. It just felt inevitable that Everton would get something out of that game. And it was just after Arsenal had their first blip in basically the whole season, where they lost to Man City in the Cup, because Man City put out a strong team, Arsenal didn't, and that's probably where they lost it. Then you come into Brentford, who have caused them big problems before, and they have the, maybe it is psychological as well as physical advantage of being massive lads. Like, so they can play direct, they can really cause Arsenal problems in the way that Man City get caused problems by Brentford. If you have small technical players, then you often get that sort of issues coming through. And then you come in off the back of, uh-oh, we might be in trouble here because we just lost to Everton and now we've drawn with Brentford. That's not good. Points dropped. And the performance wasn't great against Brentford either, I thought. And then you come into Man City, who obviously you're worried about, who have already beaten you in the Cup recently, and you don't want to let this drop. And then that sort of slides here. So then you could say, again, my football is stupid. Well, they've come around again with mentality, the psychological part of it. They've managed to get through it. I think one good example of it on the pitch of how they got back to this game is when Zinchenko scored that goal, the long range hit, which they've got quite good at, Arsenal. They must be practicing that in training. The ball, the shot from like 22 yards out.
Yeah, completely unmarked from a corner, wasn't it? It's bizarre.
This is something I was going to say to you, that maybe we should do in a, well, maybe we'll do this in a video. This is how TIFO works, right? Is that there's definitely something where, like, Partey scored a goal, remember? That they were,
he scored identical goals.
Well, they know where the space is. So yeah, that if everyone's pushing forward and they're creating these things here, then what a lot of teams have done is start to have someone at the edge of the box free for a cutback. But then Arteta's gone like another 5 yards back to someone even further back, just to the side. And Zinchenko scored that goal. Great, great hit. Great control and technique. But then rather than going like, yeah, so back in the game, just run straight back to the other half. That's like the general leading the troops. Let's go. We're not done here yet, which is good. That's what you want to see. And that's what they've got the right mentality in their Arsenal.
It's just about who wants it more.
It genuinely is.
What's really interesting about this, right?
Been here for 20 minutes.
Everyone's like, talking about mentality here, but if you actually look at the chances that Arsenal created where they probably should have scored versus the ones that they actually did, like, it felt like they scored very low value chances and they missed all of the, like, Ødegaard missed like an absolute sitter,
yeah,
which is nuts. Like that. So, like, when we're talking about mentality, surely mentality is in those moments. Like, I feel as though Arsenal were a little bit rocked in that game, and they got back into it just because they pinged it in from a couple of like long distance shots, and that's that. And then, like, obviously a break at a corner where the goalkeeper committed. It's like,
maybe I would see something totally different if they hadn't scored two late ones, and Odegaard had missed that big chance. It's a weird thing. Someone else missed a big one as well, wasn't there? It was, I can't remember who it was.
I think Nketiah missed a few headers, didn't he? Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing where you think, oh well, they should have bought a striker then, because Nketiah can't do it. He's been brilliant, and his goal scoring record is far superior to Gabriel Jesus, especially this season. So he's actually probably a really not a better option than Jesus, but he gives them something extra.
We're also talking about games that they lost, which they didn't have the mentality to turn around, right? Or they lost a couple of games. They drew to Brentford. Like, were they not mentality yeah. monsters then?
What do we know?
Yeah.
We don't know anything.
We don't.
Nothing.
Let's end the podcast.
Yeah.
So, won it more. Goals change games. That's all fine. One of the long range shots did go into the net off Emi Martinez's head, which could be one of the funniest things. I don't mind Emi Martinez.
It's a great header, wasn't it?
I like him. And
I love a long range goal. It's very rare. There was a statistical decline in long range goals for a long time in the Premier League as expected goal models became more and more used and relied upon. And I think I covered this for the Telegraph when I used to write for them when I was a real boy. And they stopped shooting from long range as much because obviously it's low value chances. I spoke to, who did I speak to? Matt Taylor, the guy who used to play for Portsmouth.
Yes.
And he's now, I think he's a youth coach, maybe at Spurs. I can't remember where he is or was. Anyway, I spoke to him because he used to be able to hit them from long range. And I was asking, has there been a notable decline in players doing that? And he gave me an answer, which I can't remember.
Wow.
Basically, no one's coaching them not to do it, but I think at youth level, you don't want to discourage kids from doing that. But they wouldn't see as many, and maybe there's just a different kind of tactical coaching going on, so you would do it less. But anyway, Jorginho hits it from long range.
Well,
good hit.
Go watch Rotherham, because that's where Matty Taylor is manager of now.
Is that right?
Yeah. I think that might be the wrong Matt
Taylor. Is it the wrong Matt Taylor? Didn't delete it quickly enough.
I know, Steve. I know, it's all right.
I was wondering that, and then I was like, oh no. And then you wrote it in. I was like,
that's
oh,
why
yeah.
you shouldn't trust me, unfortunately.
We can cut this bit out, right? Yeah.
Oh, we'll see.
We'll see. Yeah. Brilliant. Great. Yeah, anyway, Emi Martinez, you're right about all the long range shooting. That's great, JJ, but I do want to bring it back to the fact that the ball went in off his head, which did seem to be quite enjoyable for a lot of people because Emi Martinez had been taking his time. He's that kind of fellow, I suppose, who you can kind of appreciate how he does football.
Do you mean as though he was time wasting, and then so it's a
yes.
just reward?
As Steve has popped in here, did he shit house himself?
This sounds like something an Arsenal fan would write.
Well, I don't think that's a secret.
Well, I mean, this guy is a World Cup winner, and some of his shenanigans during the World Cup final are exactly why they managed to win it and on the way all the way there. So you've got to take the good with the bad. Martinez is really good at that sort of stuff. I don't think it's a just reward. I thought the narrative would be that he's a secret agent for Arsenal helping them win the game. I thought that's would be what people would do. But I've not been on the internet much this weekend.
I wasn't listening because I'm looking up Matthew Taylor.
Yeah.
He was most recently a manager at Walsall, but he is now no longer coaching. He was at Tottenham under 18s.
Like yeah, that's when I spoke to him. Yeah.
So there's too many Matthew
there's
Taylors.
There's many Matthew. We've talked a lot about Danilos, haven't we?
We did before we started recording.
There's a lot of Matthew Taylors in
Danilos.
So we Googled how many Danilos are there. And then professional football, how many did you find?
Like there was like 10 pages on Transfermarkt. I didn't go through all of them.
Well, that's all grand. There was some freshness to Arsenal in terms of we had Jorginho hitting the shot that went in off Emi Martinez's head.
Yes.
Trossard was in as well, which is a bit of freshness. I like him a lot as a player. So
very different player to Martinelli.
Yeah.
Indeed, which sort of touches on what JJ was saying. But you've got those elements of I suppose, more to play with for Arteta, which over when you are trying to adjust yourself to people adapting to what you're doing, puts you in good stead.
Yeah, I mean, Trossard is like a much narrower player, right, than Martinelli. And it was interesting seeing Trossard. He's just skinnier.
Very thin, yeah.
if you actually catch him side on, you can't see
He's two-dimensional,
yeah. It's quite hard to mark, yeah.
Which brings us back to quantum physics and the sixth dimension.
Did you ever read that book, Flat Stanley, when you were growing up? Mm. Like a kid that got squashed. That
rings a bell.
He could like sneak under doors because he was that thin.
Mm. What did he do with that power?
He plays for Arsenal.
I can't remember. I think the denouement of the novel, if children's novels can have denouements, was that someone stuck a bike pump in his mouth and pumped him back up.
Jeez.
Yeah.
In a nice way.
So don't stick to what you are. You change to fit in.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Great moral, that. I was at the press box at Wigan Norwich on Saturday, and it was funny how many people did like the idea of Arsenal tripping up, which is a bit mean, isn't it, really?
And people just inbuilt with the idea of like the people ahead getting worse. Like people didn't used to hate Jurgen Klopp until he like became a manager who always won, and now they hate him.
People in the entire United Kingdom just love watching people fail when they're doing well.
Trip up and land on their face.
Yeah. No one's allowed to be successful. Anyone who has any sort of success has to be taken down. There's probably a few exceptions.
Well, in terms of teams who are successful and being taken down, how about Manchester City at Nottingham Forest?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't give out the score for the other one, so let me say it was Nottingham Forest 1-1 Manchester City. There we go. It was 0-1 for a long period of time. And then boom, Chris Wood, not offside, equalising late on. How did Manchester City not win this game?
I feel like it's...
Were they just unlucky, John?
It's very
really
hard
unlucky,
to analyse
so
these
unlucky.
Games, right? Because, you know, there is a possible world, back to quantum mechanics again.
Yes.
There's a possible world that is not too far away from our own, in which we're sitting in this room talking about how Arsenal lost, Man City won, now Man City are in the driving seat for the Premier League. And it obviously didn't happen that way. But Man City absolutely battered Forest and they didn't manage to score enough goals to beat them. This happens sometimes in football. Sometimes you can play well and not win, and sometimes you can not play well and win. What the conclusion of this is, I don't know. But it's very hard to analyse, I think, games where there's a clear dominant team who don't come through. But it happens with Manchester City. This is, I guess, the occupational hazard of their play style. That they dominate games in certain ways, but you force teams back and then you allow them openings to actually take you apart, which, yeah.
Staying on quantum mechanics, which obviously I know very much about, I had a dream last night where I woke myself up and I woke up. Like I was walking through into my room and saw me and then woke me up. Isn't that weird?
That is very weird.
It was really disconcerting. I've been thinking about it ever since. I feel weird today.
I had a very long dream about frontline pressing systems the other day.
Oh my God.
It was as boring as it sounded.
You two living up to your...
I'd been thinking about pressing all day and I dreamed about pressing. Imagine that.
I cannot imagine it. I suppose Erling Haaland maybe woke himself up thinking, oh, I did stick that chance away. And
That's another example, right? Where in another dimension that is concurrently happening is that Haaland he scores that hit that he puts over the bar and then it changes it.
I think this is a slight shortcoming in him. I think he just too often tries to hit the thing too hard. Like he will always just leather it. Like if he'd have just taken a little bit off, he didn't have to hit it that hard.
That's how he gets goals, because it goes in when other people would take shots that would be saved. It's why he scores many more.
Are you saying that if he was a little bit more nuanced in his shooting, he would have more than the 26 goals he currently has in the Premier League?
If anything, he hit it too well. You know, it just kept rising.
I don't mean John's job, well, and yours, is to analyse football, but I just feel like there's very little to do with Haaland because he knows what he's doing.
He knows what he's doing and he can do what he wants to do,
yeah.
Which is a potent combination.
I also think like games like this, I think everyone's allowed to have one of those where you're just not quite as up for it. It's not even Forest away. Do you really care? You should win. You think you'll win. You're
so
good.
Who wants it more?
Exactly. But these things happening again, like you're not clinical. Like Foden runs through on goal, just gets caught in a little bit of two minds what to do with it and then loses where he is and doesn't get the pass away, doesn't get the shot away and falls over. And you're thinking, it's just... That's another football man thing to say, but it's very just one of those days, isn't it? It just happens sometimes and it's hard to get yourself out of that.
Well, Steve Cooper is obviously a tactical genius. As he said, this is what the game needed to be. This was how they saw it. And it played perfectly. You know,
Steve
they
Cooper
would
used
miss...
to do this against Marcelo Bielsa, and it used to drive me insane. Like we battered them. Where was he at?
Swansea. Week after week for Swansea, 1-0 wins.
And then he'd be like, "Yes, you know, because he had a tactical plan for his games, like most coaches. I believe most coaches have tactical
plans.
And because whenever he won, then it was because you know the tactical plan was there. It was there. So it must have been a piece of tactical genius to beat them. So yeah, there's games where we battered his teams and then they would have a win and he'd be like in the press box afterwards. Scott Parker also did this. Famous tactical genius Scott Parker.
Forest staying up.
It looks that way at the moment. Yeah,
Well, they've got good players. I mean,
they
so bought many
50
good players.
Of them.
Like the new ones that you just forget they've just recently signed. Like Keylor Navas, that Champions League serial winner is in the team. Felipe, he was at Atletico Madrid, quite important, wasn't he? He was like a really, really good defender. Of course, playing next to Jonjo Shelvey and Jack Colback. Like,
and Remo Freuler. Yeah.
Bernardo Silva's shot a little bit close to Keylor Navas. Maybe should have got a...
I think there's enough on it that he couldn't reach it. Another example of City doing something that Arsenal are doing, taking shots from slightly longer range.
It's the future.
It works, yeah. Long range shots for me.
This running order is very biased, do you not think? We've got here Steve saying, John maybe will say something about XG and how City should, square quotes, have won the game, but they failed to win 8 games out of 24 this season, 4 losses, 4 draws.
Are we going for Steve? Thank you.
Yeah, and in the Arsenal section, we actually missed the bit where he was like, are we into the soft factor stuff with some of the Arsenal things? So suggesting that actually Arsenal have this magic that no one else has.
So sometimes you think we're a biased podcast, but you know what? We're fighting it.
Yeah, we're fighting the bias.
The bias is there. We're trying to call it out.
Steve
calling out our own bias. Where does it leave the title challenge then? In terms of, is it
that there is one?
Yes.
And Man United are creeping into it.
Yes.
And I think they are genuinely good. I don't think John does. I think
I think Manchester United are good. Don't get me wrong. I think they're like from where they should have been, given where they were at the beginning of the season. The turnaround has been remarkable, and I'm on record in many places saying that I think that Erik ten Hag is a brilliant manager, and it's like one of the worst things to happen to Manchester United as a Leeds United fan to have him be the coach there. But I do think that people are maybe overrating where they're at, because I think there's games where they come through and they play really well, and there's other games where they struggle through, and I don't think they quite have the level of consistency yet to be really challenging. But yeah, at the moment, at the top, everything's sort of up and down every week. Like Manchester City, as Steve says, are losing and dropping points way more than you expect them to, regardless of whether or not there's some kind of underlying number chicanery going on. But yeah, it's a fun league, right?
I like it.
It's nice having a different team at the top. It's nice having teams becoming competitive. It'd be nice if the top six was as strong as it should be. I noticed that Spurs crept into the top four again, so that's kind of fascinating. But yeah, it just seems to be the case that we can't have the top six all be good at the same time. But I guess that's because teams naturally have cycles. And
and another reason, like, football is stupid. Like the narrative that Liverpool are broken now, they're gone, that they've, you know, Klopp should leave. People have said these things. Mm. They are 2 games behind, and what is it? If they win both their games in hand, they will go above Spurs. No, just 1 point behind Spurs. Is that right? 38, 41, yeah. Yeah. And then that's them just on the edge of Champions League places, and there's still lots of games left to play.
Nuts, which we're going to come on to. But before we do, I just wanted to bring up the synopsis of Flat Stanley.
Oh, yes, please
which
do.
Which is in here. The book recounts the adventures of Stanley Lambchop.
Stanley Lambchop?
Do you think that's his real, like, birth given? No. After he is squashed flat by a bulletin board while sleeping.
That doesn't seem very heavy, does it? A bulletin board.
I don't know what the
physical matter is. If you were to have a children's novel and the child, the plot is the child gets flattened by something, you wouldn't go for a bulletin board.
That's curious. I mean, there's a link through to it, but I haven't
Anvil?
Gotten on that.
Anvil, yeah, exactly.
Well, that would... Yeah. Anyway, he survives, good news, and decides to make the best of being flat. Soon he discovers that he is able to enter locked rooms by sliding under the door. Shall I continue? Over the course of the story, he also rolls up to go out to a park, and he is used as a kite by his brother. I am reading all of this, by the way. Another special advantage of being flat is that Flat Stanley can visit his friends in California by mailing himself in an envelope.
That's genius.
Stanley even helps catch art museum thieves by disguising himself as a painting on the wall of himself, I presume. Eventually, Stanley becomes tired of his flatness, and his brother restores his proper shape with a bicycle pump.
So what does he learn in the end then? What's his art?
I think that's, we all have to think about that.
Yeah.
Being different is fun.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's better to fit in with everyone else. That's the moral of that story.
Have your
are you weird? Yeah. Try and sort it out with
have
a bicycle
your fun.
Pump.
Have your fun with it. Make the most of it. But it can't last forever. So eventually you're going to wake yourself up. I think that's probably what happens.
It was really genuinely very freaky, Matt.
Well, I'll tell you who else will be feeling pretty flat. That is Newcastle United fans. We'll be speaking about them individually just after this break.
That's a lovely segue.
Thanks.
That's Steve-O, wasn't it?
Was it yours?
That's a Steve-O
one. I was trying to read it and say it to the camera
Steve-O
at the
hit.
Same time.
Ian Irving here, host of the world's biggest Manchester United podcast, Talk of the Devils, brought to you by The Athletic, of course. It's the most exciting week of football for the club in years, with another league victory teeing up the Barcelona second leg and the League Cup final on Sunday. So make sure you join me, Andy Mitten, Laurie Whitwell and Carl Anker for this week's episodes. There's Takeover Talk in there, of course, too. Just search for Talk of the Devils on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Let's move on then, shall we, to Newcastle United 0 to Liverpool, 2 goals in the first 20 minutes and a red card for Nick Pope. Possibly the most unfortunate timed red card in the history of football. It was a bit of a surprise as well, wasn't it? Like, we're kind of expecting Liverpool to lose and Newcastle to continue flawlessly.
Well, I don't know if we expected Liverpool to lose, but I thought we knew that Liverpool are in a bad moment. As everyone says.
That is it. Bad moment.
A bad moment. I have to say things are moments.
Not anymore.
No.
They took a bicycle pump to it, didn't they?
That's yeah.
They were pumped up for the game.
Yes. Yes, very good. Newcastle have been in the top four for most of the season. They've dropped out of it now. They're on what you might think is a slight blip. I think it's probably returned to where probably they actually are. But maybe they can keep the psychology and momentum up, as we've been talking about earlier in the podcast.
Just want it more.
Want it more. I thought Newcastle were brilliant at the start of this game. They were so good, and they had Liverpool. They were targeting like quite heavily Alexander-Arnold and that Liverpool right side by shifting the ball to Newcastle's right and pinging it with a big switch pass out to that side, and they were really, really causing trouble. Saint-Maximin was having his bit of fun with on that side. They were creating chances, looked really good. Then all of a sudden, Liverpool score. With a really quick counter-attack. I think Nunez scores the first one, doesn't he? Yeah.
It's a great finish.
Puts his foot through it, yeah. A great finish, lovely goal. And that's them up. And then all of a sudden, same thing. Newcastle keep going. Liverpool hit them on the break, just get a goal. And you think, that's the game probably done. Even though Newcastle started superbly. And then it is absolutely done when that highliner is caught out one more time with Nick Pope coming out. And then he takes a big like clatter, like so he goes to head the ball, can't quite reach it. It's very similar in the way that Phil Foden can't reach the ball when he's trying to do that thing and gets something for us. It's very odd. That maybe just people can't. Maybe the changing light has made everyone go funny. Anyway, tries to head the ball, doesn't. He smashes his head off it on the floor, which would hurt. And he puts his hands out instinctively to then gather the ball, and then obviously handballs it.
I mean, he's trying to head the ball when it's on the floor.
He's not. And he's trying to head it, but he's just not close enough. He still goes for it, and then he smashes his head off the floor with it.
But why didn't he just try and kick it? I don't understand why.
Did he misread the ball? It looked to me like he misread the ball. I think it bounced funny. And then he realised he was going to try and head it away, but then realised he was completely out of position.
And he's committed. You've got to do something. Yeah.
So just grab the ball.
Well, the ball grabbing, I think, honestly, is just natural instinct. Yeah. After like crashing his head off it, he just goes out, puts his hands there, and it's there. And then that's why that happens. I mean, I obviously don't know what Nick Pope's actually thinking, because although I can wake myself up in dreams in third person, I can't see into Nick Pope's mind.
Maybe he'll dream about that.
Maybe he'll dream. Maybe I've been reading it.
Yes.
Remote viewing. Have you heard of this?
I've not. No.
Remote viewing. There are people. Please, like, everyone who listens to this, I'm not a mad conspiracy I'm not mad.
Just keep going.
I'm very skeptical of all these things.
Safe space.
But remote viewing is where you can access what someone else sees by being able to like go into a like hypnotic style state where you can then access what other people are seeing, as though like in Game of Thrones where the bird boy can see all stuff. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Bird boy, right? It works. Is that, yes. That when you just give people names, you know what they roughly are. Yeah. So it's that sort of idea, because he's like he's part tree or something, isn't he?
I've not watched.
He does have a strong connection to the tree,
right? So then he can see all stuff, because it's the Force basically is what they're doing, right? So they've done that from Star Wars. So this is what they have. But then apparently a lot of people claim that there are military divisions in certain countries that also have remote viewers who try and prevent people from accessing secret places.
So it's just become a game of football.
Well, then
with people's heads.
I mean, the men who stare at goats, that was a real CIA project. That was a real thing that they came out of. And so this is one of those things, remote viewing. So anyway, Newcastle were unlucky in this game. And I think Liverpool, deserved a win in the end because they got through it. But this is what you see. I thought Newcastle were genuinely good at the start. And so Liverpool are on the up.
I only watched this game until the red card, because I don't enjoy watching 10 v 11. But I noticed that
Hang on. But so you just don't watch games
if it's my team, I'll watch it.
But no, but if like, it was two, just a football match, you would be like, oh, there's a red card.
There's nothing really interesting happens tactically, right? Because you're like, well, it was 10 v 11.
What about the sport? The psychology?
In a game like that, especially because they're 2-0 up, right? They go down to Liverpool, go up one. No, that's not how it happens, is it? It's the other way around. Newcastle go down one. See, this is how little I watch games when there's a red card.
Up two, red.
Liverpool up two.
Up one player.
And with a player up.
Two goals.
I don't think that's a particularly interesting set of circumstances.
You know that white card that was shown in the game recently for sporting behaviour, yes, wasn't it? What league was that in? I can't remember where that was.
Well, that's too big a question. I'm sure Steve will look it up.
Well, there was a thing you may have seen this, that it was a referee who awarded a white card. I think FIFA are trialing this thing to award good sportsmanship. What if you award the white card, you get an extra player?
Yeah,
that'd be good.
Then you are at one up.
Yeah,
and when anyway, that's good. Yeah, so I was going to just say Nick Pope's obviously out of the League Cup final, which is bad for him.
It's a real shame.
I'm guessing he wasn't thinking that as he was trying to claw the ball. I think that was probably the last
thing. And for context, he is hugely important to how good Newcastle have been. Their defensive record is formed on like a really strong defensive structure. We've got a video on it on Tifo IRL. If you want to watch that, it goes into it in far more detail than I've got time to do right now. But Nick Pope saves, I can't remember the numbers, I won't say it, but like his expected goals prevented, something like that, is really high. He's just genuinely good. And he's also, I think, maybe top in the league for keeper sweepings, as in he comes off his line really early to prevent things going like exactly what he did against Salah, to then head the ball.
And he did it like in the third minute of the game successfully, didn't he?
It was so important how Newcastle play. And they can play that high line because he does it. And that's what Liverpool caught him out twice because he wasn't able to. They did it really well.
This might be a really boring question. Is it right that he misses the League Cup final because he's been sent off in the Premier League?
Yes.
Yeah, that is true. And then Dubravka's...
I know it's right, but is it right?
Oh, is it right?
Is it fair?
It's, I don't know, probably
seems
not.
Seems very unfair to me.
I like the redemption arc that Loris Karius gets now because he'll play in the League Cup final.
He has to play, doesn't he?
Because yeah, Dubravka
is cup-tied because he's played for United and could win a medal either way, I guess. He definitely. I think they mentioned it on Match of the Day that he will get a winner's medal if Manchester United win.
He must have played in there.
Because he played in the tournament for Manchester United while he was on loan. I don't know. But then if he doesn't play for Newcastle, does he then get a medal? If he could be the only Newcastle player that only gets a winner's medal if Manchester United win the League Cup final.
I'm sure he is. Yeah.
But
coming back to the
Loris Karius,
the unfairness of bans from cards, I think I'm right in saying that Paul Pogba, when he came back to Manchester United, had to miss a game in the Premier League because the rules in Serie A are if you get a ban in Serie A, it counts across all leagues. And so he was brought in, couldn't make his debut in the first game because he had a ban. But maybe Steve can check that up.
Well, I mean, it's just to stop all those people moving after they get a red card so that they don't get a ban.
We buried him earlier. I think Steve's within his right not to do that for us now.
Yeah, that's true. Steve.
He has been working on the white card story. Football history was made on this Saturday, whenever the Saturday was. For the white card, it was shown in the match between Sporting Lisbon and Benfica. Quite a big game, obviously. It was shown in recognition of fair play. Do you get anything from that? You didn't really get anything other than like the white. It's like a gift card, really. Does anyone want a gift card in the middle of a football match? It's not really useful, is it?
Well, those pictures that you see of footballers getting pizza after the game when they get man of the match.
Yes.
They're good, aren't they?
Is it Connor Salmon who got that while playing in Scotland?
There's some team who used to give out pies as well. So you'd like win a game of football and then have a picture of a dude with a pie.
Yeah, that's the way it should be. Go back to commercial roots of football. Have Partick still got the really scary mascot that they had redesigned?
The David Strickley one, yeah. I can't remember what his name is, though. Yeah. Yeah, Strickley's.
Danilo, probably.
Strickley's doing well. Yeah.
Well, that's good. What was the other bit I was going to look at? Oh, because of Liverpool, that's exciting. Can they get back into the top four now? We sort of touched on it earlier. But now I'm looking at the table thinking, oh, no, they actually could get back into the top four because it's not a million miles away. Yeah, and they've got players coming back.
Well, there's 38 games. They are one of the best teams in the league. They just had a terrible season. There's loads of reasons for it, which we've, again, there's so many. We've covered it a lot in videos and we'll continue to do so. But like you see, Salah's kind of struggling this season. There's a lot to do with the right side. Alexander-Arnold's been targeted a lot this season. They've really struggled with it. John did a great video on the press not functioning the way it wants to. They've got a transition of players. They've also had the nucleus of the same players for a long time, and teams tend to need shaking up. And one of the best things that Sir Alex Ferguson did and that we've seen Guardiola doing now is getting rid of key players even though they're in their peak, because you need to change things up, if anything, just for the dressing room mentality and psychology, or just to change it so people can't predict what you're doing. If Arsenal keep doing what they're doing exactly the same and don't change much, add a couple of players in 2 years' time, and they still got the key core, everyone will know how they play. They won't be as successful. It's what Liverpool have, exactly the same thing. You've got refresh, add to it, make it different. And Jurgen Klopp appears to be very, very aware of this. This is his seventh year, eighth year, isn't it? And he lasted, was it seven at Mainz and seven at Borussia Dortmund? And the last one at Dortmund was a disaster as well, because, again, needed to refresh and probably do that sort of stuff. It's what, I keep saying, Ferguson did so well at Manchester United, was just brutally get rid of players whenever he wanted to, just separate the friendship you have with them and just treat it to be a winner.
Man City do that pretty well as well, because there's an interview with Rio Ferdinand and Pep Guardiola where Pep Guardiola's like, how many Premier Leagues did you win? And he's like, five, six, however many it is. And he's like, was any of those teams like exactly the same team? And he was like, no, you have to constantly change your players up. It's a real skill to be able to do. He also privileged if he can bring in players pretty easily as well, but yeah.
True. I'm sure Jurgen will be desperate to prove that point, just to get to that eighth season.
Worth saying that like Liverpool have completely decimated their recruitment department recently, so they've lost Michael Edwards, who was the director of football, and they've moved another few, I think is it Ian Graham, I think his name is, who was in charge of the data side of things. I think they both moved on, so that I think will impact the way that they rebuild the team as well. There's arguments to be made that the players that they brought in haven't necessarily suited the system that fixed the problems that Klopp's system has.
Well, and that would be a case of he'll maybe need to adapt what he has to what he has available to him, and that's kind of what you touched on in that pressing video, is that you have to change what you do, because you can't just replace Mane with like for like. So you've got to change the way you then press and build and create.
It takes players time, doesn't it, as well? Cody Gakpo's now got a couple of goals in two games, so it's starting to see a bit from him. And we should mention Stefan Bajetic. I knew I wasn't going to pronounce that right, because he looked tidy in midfield, which is somewhere Liverpool could do with a little bit of fresh impetus.
Yeah, that is probably the bit you'd want to refresh. I think there's... I don't want to hammer home on Alexander-Arnold, because obviously he's a really good player and that he's been done to death. I think Gary Neville did it best, pointing out how he could be just this elite level right back. But the things that he lacks are so commonly targeted by rival managers that it becomes a real problem, and then detrimental to Mo Salah on the right as well, because he has to come back. Jurgen Klopp, if you watch the side, I often watch what the manager's doing, side of the pitch. And the first like 20 minutes before Liverpool took the lead in this game, he was going absolutely nuts at what I think was the closest players to him. I think it was Alexander-Arnold and Salah, because when I was looking at him going crazy, you look at the pitch and Alexander-Arnold's out of position and Salah's nowhere to be seen on that right side, and they're in a different transitional shape getting back into their defensive structure. So I can only assume that's what it was. But that's a case of them going up, and what's worked before isn't quite there. And Alexander-Arnold, it feels very mean to say bad things about him, because he gets so much of it from places. But I think a lot of it's really valid. And then he does make up for it by being absolutely brilliant in certain situations as well. Like he's technically a fantastic footballer. Lovely to watch as well. And you want him in most teams. If he was at Real Madrid or Barcelona, he'd be easily one of their best players as well. But that's the thing. And then you put him into Liverpool against teams like, I don't know, Newcastle. They target it with players like Alan St-Maximin. He'll take him on 1v1, try and take him on a little trip. When he goes forward, they've got players in position ready to go for that left bit. They'll focus the play on the right to go and lead the team one way so they can target it. And they've done it for years. But weirdly, when I looked at the numbers a long time ago, a lot of the goals they conceded, the chances came from the other wing, where Andrew Robertson is, who is also a brilliant fullback.
Well, I think they push Robertson further forward often, and then so teams target the spacing behind him and then try and hit the back post and overload on Alexander-Arnold.
Mitrovic
right?
did it earlier this season, with that back post header. Exactly. And then so like talking about the midfield, what they used to have, the very best Klopp team for me was when you had Fabinho, Wijnaldum and Henderson. That was the main three. Henderson covering for Alexander-Arnold, being a busy little bee in the middle of the pitch. Great, like...
pressing forward as well, right? He used to just get really high up the pitch as well in pressing moments.
He's like the sort of N'Golo Kante of Liverpool, basically. He's doing loads and loads of work for lots of people. And although he's technically not the best footballer in the world ever, he is so important to how they play. And a lot of football is more about than just being good technically. It's about what you bring to the team as a captain, leader, legend. And then you've got Fabinho, obviously classy player. Ronaldo, very much box to box, a real like classy player, but works very hard and has got the pace to get back and work in transitional moments. And then what they've gone to is Thiago, who is very good technically. His numbers show that he tries to press and win the ball a lot, but doesn't just do it very well. He's not really got a presence defensively, Thiago. And you can see him just not quite there. He lacks a lot of speed as well. Henderson's been in and out with injury. It's been a problem. Fabinho hasn't been quite himself as well. He keeps going in for weird challenges. It could easily be red cards as well. Don't know what's happened to that guy.
I feel like he's just getting less protection, right? So he just gets into these moments where he's super exposed as well.
And Bayetic seems really neat and tidy. He seems like quite a Barcelona-y player, the way he plays. He's got a nice, like, takes a touch in the half turn, takes players out of the game, and then moves it forward. I need to watch him more, but I think he's, yeah.
I was talking to Mark Carey of The Athletic about Jorginho Wijnaldum, because we were talking about the midfield problem, which is Liverpool always seem to be struggling between having like really functional midfields where you can get a huge amount of upside from pressing, or bringing in more talented technical players to then get an upside there. Because I think what they found is that you know, they moved to the fullback system with these two really exciting creative fullbacks creating in different ways because they had a functional midfield, so they needed their creativity to come from somewhere else. Teams then found out how to exploit these really aggressive fullbacks, and so they're much less likely to push their fullbacks as far forward. And so then you have the problem like, well, where's our creativity coming from? And again, the solution to that seems to be like, well, we need to have a more, you know, we need to bring in more technical players in midfield. And so they seem to be on this cycle of constantly doing that. But I spoke to Mark Carey about Jorginho and Wijnaldum, and he said he tried to profile players who are similar to Wijnaldum. Like, what was the, because a lot of people say, you know, he's sort of the missing piece of that jigsaw. And the player he came up with in the Premier League who most closely matched Wijnaldum was Joe Willock of Newcastle.
Is that right?
Interesting.
Well, yeah, very box-to-box player, classy,
really good
as well.
Out of possession.
Really good technically, works really hard at possession as well. Good player.
This is my theory that Newcastle are like the next Liverpool.
I see so many things to it, yeah.
Well, if Liverpool are to finish in the top four, they'd probably have to do it at Newcastle's expense. So that's an interesting subplot. He says.
It's been such a narrative weekend, hasn't it? Do you not think it's just been like everything that could have happened has happened? Arsenal losing and then winning, and then Man City winning and then not winning, and, you know, Nick Pope getting a red card in a hilarious manner, the ball bouncing off Martinez's head, all of these things that like...
A goalie caught out from a corner, that never happened. Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
Narratives. Why did Unai Emery not say, can you not go up? Why did he not like...
They were trying to get an equaliser.
No, but he said he didn't ever want his goalkeeper to do it.
Maybe can't hear him shouting. I don't know.
Maybe. But I just don't like absolutely hammer him afterwards if you've literally made no effort to tell him not to do it. But I don't know. Maybe. It's fine. It's fine.
You're saying that Unai Emery got it wrong?
Well, I just didn't see the point of hammering him having not said, Emmy, can you not up there? But
effectively, you're losing and then you lose, right? Not a huge amount has changed in that situation. You've dropped a goal difference point. Maybe
no one really cares.
About.
That's the point, isn't it? There, we do have some stuff we can summarise before we speak about Chelsea. Looking forward to that one. Martin Dubravka can only get a League Cup winner's medal if Manchester United win the League Cup, even though he's a Newcastle United player. That's weird. Paul Pogba was indeed suspended when he came back to Manchester United. He had two yellow cards in his final two games for Juventus, which caused a suspension that was carried over from Serie A to the Premier League. Which is interesting, because apparently if a player had got two yellow cards in a Premier League fixture, they wouldn't serve their ban in the League Cup. Right. So then Nick Pope would have been fine. For clarity, the white card was used in the Portuguese Women's Cup competition between Sporting Lisbon and Benfica. And finally, on remote viewing. Remote viewing experiments have historically been criticised for a lack of proper controls and repeatability. There is no scientific evidence that remote viewing exists, and the topic of remote viewing is generally regarded as pseudoscience.
Yes, 100%.
Meanwhile, segueing perfectly into the fact that one team who probably won't win a trophy this season or challenge for the top four are Chelsea.
Could have made a joke about remote viewing the top four there. Disappointed in you, but there we are.
True. Sorry. It's all right.
The top four is looking very remote viewing for Chelsea right now, isn't it?
Thanks, John. You've done it. This is nice. You did it. I was giving you the room to step up. And
Thanks, you've
bailed me out. Chelsea 0, 1 Southampton. Who's going to bail Chelsea out, John?
Yeah, I've been thinking about Chelsea all weekend. I made a video.
As well?
Yeah.
As pressing.
And there's some interesting things behind what's going on at Chelsea. Chelsea fans maybe not quite so lenient in their opinions about where the club is at right now than I am, but I know exactly how they feel, having been in that situation myself with my team this season. So, but one of the things I found was that we talked a lot about what Graham Potter's really good at. Graham Potter at Brighton was he developed this really flexible system that allowed him to do that problem solving that we talked about with Arsenal. So you can solve different phases of play. You can get overloads in certain areas. You can pull teams around. You can recognise how they're structured and set your structure up to cause some problems in that way. He started off trying to do that. We saw some fairly interesting things. We saw Raheem Sterling being used as a sort of situational wing back at one point. All of the things that we expect from Graham Potter. But then over time that has stopped, and now Chelsea, I think, are playing a really sort of bog standard 4-2-3-1, particularly in the wake of the January transfer window. And so in my video, I argued that what Graham Potter has done is he's tried to implement certain ideas, maybe hasn't got the buy-in that he wanted from the players, and has recognised now that because he needs to get results, better to just have a really solid system, bring in all of the great players that he's got at his disposal and let them do the problem solving through their ability rather than necessarily through tactical solutions. The interesting thing about this is that actually, if you look at the underlying numbers, which again, I will say with a pinch of salt because the underlying numbers aren't everything, but there has been a bit of an uptick in form since they've done that. They are generating better and more chances than their opponents generally. So it does seem as though Chelsea are heading the right way at the moment. But the big question is, I think, and this isn't a question about Chelsea in general, because I feel as though the model that they've had in the past has been bring in elite players and then get managers who can just sort of get the most out of them by hook or by crook. And I think what Todd Bowley is wanting to do is he's wanting to get Chelsea to the same level as clubs like Arsenal and Manchester City, which is and Manchester United as well, which is have a manager who can raise their level through that tactical aspect as well. So have elite players, but also get them implementing tactical ideas as well, so that you can then challenge consistently at the top. And at the moment, Graham Potter isn't being able to do that. So it seems to me that what he's doing is just moving to a more basic system, get the results he needs to get a solid footing, and then start maybe thinking about implementing those tactical ideas, which is what happened for Erik ten Hag, I think, this season. He came in, tried to implement those tactical ideas early on, and obviously didn't work out. And so they I think, changed things a little bit to make it less build-up heavy than he would have wanted to. I think the same sort of thing is maybe happening with Chelsea right now. So Chelsea aren't very good at the moment, I would say. They're heading in the right direction. There's lots of problems with the way that they play. And yeah, I think that the big question is going to be like, do the club give Graham Potter the rest of the season to see whether or not they can get to a level where they can start seeing those green shoots of something coming through? Now, a lot of Chelsea fans have lost patience, and that's fair enough. That's their prerogative. I agree that when you're watching a team who are playing turgid football week in, week out, and people are there saying, well, the underlying numbers look okay, like, who cares? Like, I don't...
That's an impression of yourself, John.
That's an impression of myself, yeah. I don't go and watch Leeds because I want to feel as though the underlying numbers at some point are going to turn around and we'll start getting results. What I want to go is, I want to go and be entertained, right? And so I understand why Chelsea fans are frustrated, but I do think that there is some sort of turnaround here, and in the long run, it could work out. Maybe it won't work out. Maybe it won't ever work out. Maybe he's not the right guy for the job. But I think that the way that the Chelsea ownership will think, particularly being from a US background where they are very slow to move managers on, I think he may get the rest of the season, and then they'll have a discussion in the summer about whether or not they want to continue with him.
It does strike me as an issue if you've got your head coach changing how they're doing everything to try and get the results, because you need results. And then you lose to the bottom team. And so you're definitely not getting the results either. I mean, it's a bit like, it was almost like, well, where do you go from this point? Because, I don't know, they've had some good chances, obviously. But, you know, just that whole situation of losing that game, being booed off. And it's like, well, this couldn't get any worse. And then you've got the second leg against Dortmund, which it feels like, well, that's kind of almost it, really. You've got to do something from that, because then we can retain the faith in you achieving something in the Champions League, because nothing's going to happen in the Premier League.
Well, there's an inevitable point in a football manager's tenure at a club where they will lose their authority in the respect of the group. They won't suddenly trust everything they want to do. And Potter's come in with not as high, like, he is not a Hollywood star. He is very much hardworking, quiet, thoughtful, clever manager. He's meant to be. He's got a degree, I think, in people management or something like psychology.
A number of degrees, yeah.
Yeah, so like he knows
soft factors.
He knows how to manage people, basically, and that's a really important part of management. People criticize him for not being angry enough and screaming and shouting when you don't actually need to do that. That's old school, like the English mentality. Well, not just English, you know, just old school football mentality. Yeah. I know, picking on the English.
All the English folk. Wow, gosh.
Oh dear.
Did in a Scottish accent as well.
Yes, and he so like managing it calmly is a way to do it, but then. It's like very opposite to what Thomas Tuchel was and what Mourinho was. You know, like Mourinho was very strategic and not methodical. Was it pragmatic? Would change things. Basically, what I'm trying to say is Potter is trying to then manage a group of new players, young men that he's trying to like mold into a team very quickly under very extreme circumstances. He will be learning an awful lot about the difference in level step up as well from what you had at Brighton to a very different club that's also transitioning. So what's happening behind the scenes at Chelsea is a lot of transition. And then you'll see that play out in the pitch often, and that's kind of what you're seeing with Chelsea just now. Is you got that trying to manage big Hollywood stars, like the likes of Joe Felix and all those sort of guys, getting them to play well. But once you lose that authority, it's like a teacher. If a substitute teacher comes in to a class, you don't have the same level. Well, you might. They might come in and have an instant authority and charisma, and suddenly you remember being at school, Michael.
Right? Yes,
you come
just.
In, right? If you have they've had a substitute teacher.
That means hosting this podcast.
Exactly. Well, it's more like Steve Hanke losing control of me and John. And that's the thing. So it's like having a teacher. That's what it is. That those players will see the coach, you know, as their coach. But it's essentially what a teacher is, right? It's what you're doing, and you're trying to lead a group of people, and. If Potter's come in, doesn't have the charisma and like authority that those players need psychologically to then play at the level they need to. Like some people don't need an arm around them. Some people need to be screamed and shouted at because they have had a horrible childhood. And so that's what that's what gets them going. That's what gets them going, yeah.
Well, it's interesting because I have no particular, what's the word? Fondness for Manchester United. But I love what's happening there at the moment with Erik ten Hag. I love how he's doing it. I love so many of the decisions he's made. And I'm now watching them going, oh, yeah, this is really interesting. And he stepped in there and he always seemed to have the charisma and, I don't know, just the gravitas almost to be able to mold that team and to raise the level. And I suppose the question I'm asking is, I look at Graham Potter, who's I think is incredible head coach with what he's done. But I look at him and I just think, I don't know if you're a head coach for a top level, and maybe that's really cool. What do I know?
He needs to shave his hair off. That's what it is.
Do you think that's...
Us bald kings, you know, we have a gravitas to us.
I think Ten Hag... So I disagree he came in with charisma. I think he came in with not that. I think he came in and I think there was even pundits on the TV who were like, who's this guy... coming across that way.
But they're good pundits, though.
Some of them, yeah. Yeah, but because they didn't get a couple of results. Remember, they got done by Brighton and Brentford, right?
Yeah.
And so people were like, does he know what he's doing? Does he have control of the players? But what he did was, so he comes across as calm and collected in interviews, and he says what he thinks. He has a very clear thing of what he wants, and that's what he goes for. And if you don't do what he wants, then you don't get in the team. And what's happened is that because he's got results from doing what he wants, people have gone, oh, he knows what he's talking about. I'll do what he wants me to do. And so now he retains a sort of authority and charisma, which maybe other managers wouldn't have had at Man United because they've changed to things to try and fix it. So if Potter is doing that thing where he's changing, going against his principles to try and get a team together, that becomes a problem because then he's not got a clear line of what he wants and won't get to where he wants to go. And like Ten Hag will have worked on training on that, the build-up stuff that they were bad at, but they're often bad at it because De Gea is bad at it and Harry Maguire is bad at it and all these sorts of things. So then he's changed the personnel because Luke Shaw's a better footballer than Harry Maguire. So you put him in at that level and he can certainly do things that other players can't. And then you bring in other players specifically to play the way he wants. People are looking at Malacia thinking he's too lightweight. What's he going to be able to do? Really good player for exactly what Ten Hag wants. And that's why that's worked. And I think Potter has, like, he's proven himself fit to do very well at Brighton and at previous clubs in Europe, right? And he's worked really hard to get up in the very low tier of English football, where he is. And he's played at Premier League level. Like, he knows what he's talking about, this guy. And you don't have to do this thing where you scream and shout, but at a certain point, they're going to end up not qualifying for the Champions League, and that is very bad. And if they get knocked out of Champions League as well, you start to think that it's not even that the long-term project will work, it's that will they ever have the authority? Because you can't really manufacture it.
That's it, I suppose. And from Ten Hag looks like he's grown in that authority from some of the decisions he made initially with Cristiano Ronaldo and things like that. Whereas I know the last time I hosted this podcast, I think Graham Potter had 3 games. I was like, I think one of my points was like, well, Graham Potter's great. He looks like perfect fit. And now it almost looks at it and I am thinking that
I know I'm talking heaps, but I just thought, because I'm just rambling. No, it's not. Like that Ten Hag versus Ronaldo thing is massive because he then became bigger. He showed that the club is bigger than Ronaldo by winning that battle. And that is enormous. And so, like, Potter is not bigger than Chelsea. Chelsea's bigger than all the other things going on, but they've got loads of big players who just aren't, like, reined in almost.
And you could say he's made a similar decision with Aubameyang, yet actually all that's happened is Chelsea look like they haven't got a striker.
I think Aubameyang's isn't
it? It's worth saying that with Potter versus Erik ten Hag, I think actually they're both very similar coaches in a lot of respects, like, tactically, they're looking to do the same sorts of things. I do think there's differences. Yeah. But ten Hag had a whole summer to work on his team. He was able to bring in the players that he wanted, and he had those first two games where it went wrong, and that almost impelled him immediately to change and be like, right, let's think about what we're doing here, let's change a few things up. Whereas with Graham Potter, he comes in midway through a season, doesn't have much time to work with the players, and they actually, as you said, they did okay results wise in the first few games. And I think you then get into that mindset where you're like, okay, you know, there's problems. I don't think that a lot of those wins were not convincing, but you're kind of thinking, well, we're getting results, and in the long run, we're gonna be able to implement these ideas, and everything's gonna be fine. And then it didn't work out, and so it felt as though there was a certain amount of time before things flipped, and he was then moving back to a more solid system, and that's where we are now, I think. So the big question for me is, like, I agree with you. I think that the manager authority and respect in the dressing room is fundamental. If you lose that, there's no point having a manager in at a club, yeah, even if they're a very good coach.
I'm not saying it's gone either. It's
So the big question for me is, like, do they just keep him in for the rest of the season, see if things sort of start trending upwards and get to a point where they can go into the summer and be like, now you've got a pre-season, we think we can see things are heading in the right direction, you've got time to work with these players. The other thing is they brought in a load of players who, they are elite players, they are playing a system which is based around getting elite players to problem solve together. So they overload on the left-hand side usually and possess the ball and then generate these chances of getting into the box. That's going to improve just by dint of the fact that these players are going to play together and understand how their games function as well. So I think there's going to be a natural uptick there. But like I've said, the big question with Chelsea always is, you've got to have a manager who matches the elite. You can't just simply rely on elite players to get you through. Maybe you could do that in the early 2000s. Obviously, Conte did it with a tactical system. But, like, I genuinely think that what they need now is a manager to come in who is of that tactical level to actually give them that extra je ne sais quoi, which makes them an elite side.
But yeah, if say it was not Potter in charge now and they got to the summer, Potter would be perfect to come in and take over from that person.
Yeah.
I think, like just the last point on it is, like, I think the coaching aspect of this is really, really important, and people maybe just miss, right? Because preseason is where any team changes. It's like some managers can do it mid-season, but it's very difficult because of the pure amount of time you've got. You get 5 weeks basically undisturbed. You put your own friendlies in to work on certain plans to put in your principles of play so that they will be seen later in the season. A lot of it's fitness. That's the first week and a half, maybe 2 weeks of lots of fitness, but a lot of it will be done with the ball. And then you do all your tactical stuff. So it's all there and you've got clear, and you don't train all day either. You do like an hour and a half, and then you do some fitness, and you do some analysis. That's what you do. You're not in all day because they're football. That's not how that works. And so Potter now, they played a game on like Wednesday night, say. So then the next day is recovery and rest and travel maybe. And then you might be able to like send them something to look in their phone or their iPad to analyze it. Then they might come in, but it'll be a gentle sort of activation session, maybe a bit of just to keep them going conditioning. And then you might have a small session, like an hour-long session of a small-sided game to work on one little aspect. Is that really going to sit in 1 week? Then you've got another day, travel to the game, match prep, and that's it. You don't get much time to develop anything.
It's exactly what David Wagner told me at Wigan.
Is that right?
About Norwich on Saturday. Yeah.
Well, there you go. I am a genius.
There we go. Ruben Sellers at Southampton, you know, I'm all about the narrative. He looks like a manager, and Southampton had a great win, so he'll keep them up. We think we've decided that. Good on him. Well, that's Chelsea. It's not great there. Things are better at Barcelona, though. So let's speak about them just after this break. This was that break. That was the break that was. It's done. Barcelona. Well, it was a good game against Manchester United. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And Barcelona, having had lots of broken levers and issues, and still some issues, are at least flying in La Liga, JJ. They're flying. And they look like a proper coherent team. And will they beat Manchester United in the Europa League?
They could. And then the narrative will be that they're amazing. And if they don't, well, Xavi needs to work on his game. I've got a little soft spot for Barcelona, so I watch them now and again. They're doing very well this season. A lot of it's based on their defensive record, which is
nuts.
Smashing expected goals against, as in it's like unsustainable.
It's like half of what they should be at, right?
So their expected goals against is 17.78, and their goals conceded is 7. That's a difference of 10.78, which is ridiculous.
That's not sustainable, I suspect.
It's not sustainable. So like they should come back round. And when you compare it to like Real Madrid are obviously just behind them. So Real Madrid are what, 8 points off them, right? So that's what you've got. Now, expected you can't. This does not determine how well a team is playing just by expected goals or whatever and where they should be. But I think it's interesting when you look at Real Madrid and Barcelona both scored, 46 and 45 goals. So Real Madrid have 46, Barcelona have 45. From an expected goal of almost identical, 46.29 for Real Madrid, 46.26 for Barcelona. So almost identical, which is weird, with the same amount of games played. One goal extra for Real Madrid. Well done to them. Expected goals against, 20.38 for Real Madrid. They conceded 17. So that's sort of sustainable. I think if you've got a good goalkeeper, which they do in Courtois, and really good defenders, which they also do, and they're better than everyone else in the Liga because there's only like 4 good teams in the whole league. So then you, then you go to Barcelona, who, as we said, have a variance of 10.78 goals conceded. A lot of it is to do with Ter Stegen saving about 5 goals more than he should be expected to. He's a great goalkeeper. But a lot of that is then going to be basically pure luck. It is. That's why it's not sustainable, in that strikers miss a chance, or maybe it's lots of low-value chances created against them that are not scoring.
I love this, though. Like, is there a chance that the point at which it becomes unsustainable is, like, I don't know, the start of next season?
It turns the balance out over
years,
seasons. You see it over a season mostly. Like, really good players can break expected goal models. Like, Harry Kane always break them. Holland, I bet, is smashing it. Like, we've been looking at Lewandowski, always
doing
it
too hard.
Yeah, and then certain goalkeepers can save more than they're expected to because they're really good. They're in the right position. They've got exceptional agility and athleticism to be able to save things, and they read the game really well. Teams generally don't do quite the same. And you'll see, like, there's a thing that John pointed out a long time ago to me, is that when Guardiola doesn't win the league in England, it tends to be because another team in the league is overperforming their expected goals and a massive momentum. And that can do with psychology. Luck is part of that. But that's the momentum that someone else rides. At Liverpool, when they won the league, massively above what they were expected to do according to certain models. So then again, like, the models decide what it is. It's just a way to analyse it and look at it so you can see where maybe you should be. But Barcelona are defending really well. There's some tactical innovations, or they're playing a box midfield like a lot of teams are. Alejandro Balde's come on really well. He's this left back who's been around the club for a long time. Is now coming onto his own.
They play him as like a... just like a winger. Winger, basically.
Yeah. He does, in defensive phases, he defends at left back, but he's a winger, basically. He's really quick.
It's really, really fun how they get into that box midfield, right? Because they have Gavi playing as like a left wide player, but he comes in as an inside forward, and then they've been playing Frankie de Jong as the interior on that side, and he drops in alongside Sergio Busquets, who's currently injured, and then you have Pedri on the other side, and so you get this box just forming, and that creates space for Balde or Alba to get up really high.
It's like classic thing that everyone's doing now with the back four. It becomes a three because Koundé plays at right back, but he's really a centre back. Araujo plays it. I like Araujo. I think he's a really talented player at centre back as well. Next to Eric Garcia, has been playing well recently as well.
Yeah, Christensen's been playing pretty well too, hasn't he? But they changed a lot of stuff up for the Manchester United game, which was a little bit weird. But I do think, Bas, coming back to the underlying numbers thing, like when we talk about regressing to the mean in terms of the underlying numbers, It's always like, we're not saying suddenly Barcelona are going to concede 10 goals more than they should do.
Yeah.
What we're saying is that you would expect them to start conceding at a level which is consistent with the numbers that they're doing. But the point is that they're now 8 points clear. So even if they fall back to the same levels that their underlying numbers suggest, they're still the same level as Real Madrid. So it's unlikely that Real Madrid are going to make up those 8 points difference as well. That's just sort of how it happens. But I do think with Barcelona that what is different between them and Real Madrid is that Barcelona do have the ability to have a really coherent out-of-possession approach. Real Madrid under Carlo Ancelotti have never been particularly good at pressing from the front. And I think as a result of that, it really affects the extent to which you can control games. So we saw that run they had in the Champions League where it felt as though they just sort of had 5-minute bursts where they scored goals. And the rest of the time, the teams they were playing against were largely dominant. And that's just a really risky way to play. If you can't control games, then you are likely to eventually have it come back to bite you on the arse. Barcelona, I think, are different because they have the ability to control the game in different phases of play. I think there's questions about the level that they're at. And I think like the tactical stuff that Xavi has brought in, which is really fun, that box midfield, that movement and the structure he's got, is great. But I sometimes feel like that's just a structure to try and get all of his best players on the field and get his four best midfielders.
I mean, that
right?
is the game, really, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. But I also think that, you know, tactics aren't just about that sort of having smart structures. It's about having the players function within those structures well. And I think that was what was interesting about the Manchester United-Barcelona game, because I think Manchester United deserved to win that game. They played much better than Barcelona. And obviously it came off for Barcelona on the night. But I think that's where you, again, coming back to what we were talking about with Chelsea before, right? You can put really good players into a decent structure and they can be good. But if you want to be competing at the really highest level, you need to have those tactical edges that I don't think Barcelona quite have at the moment.
I also thought, like, with Xavi and Barcelona, it's proactive defending. So they're trying to win the ball early. Yeah,
aggressive, isn't it?
It's like, yeah. It comes from the whole, like, you know, Cruyff idea that you win the ball high up the pitch, that's what you do. You swarm them, that's how you win it back, and you need to put a structure in place to do it. Whereas Ancelotti is very much not that, and it's not as bad not being proactive when you defend. So that he wants to win the ball in a different way. And although it does seem like they weren't in control of some games that they won the Champions League, I think in a way that's exactly what he was looking for. So like you sort of bait teams into it.
I think that's an approach. It's definitely his approach.
And the players suit it. Like Benzema, you don't need to make him do any work like that, do you, really?
No, yeah. Look, I think the problem with Ancelotti is he's not going to be able to get those players to do that sort of high pressing.
Yeah.
And like this is the question we have every year about PSG, right? It's like, how on earth do PSG compete when they have a front three of elite creators who simply do not engage in the first line of pressure? So you're essentially playing with like eight players defensively. And that's it. And that's a problem. And I think, like, I don't think Real Madrid are that level, but I also do think that, you know, if they could bring in a player like someone like a Julian Nagelsmann, who I guess isn't flavour of the month at the moment, but his big thing has been to, you know, revolutionise every phase of play at Barcelona, get them able to press high, able to fall back, etc., defend in different ways. I think that sort of approach would benefit a team like Real Madrid. But we're back at the Chelsea level, right? If you've got elite players,
well, this
it's really hard to get buy-in for boring things like running around. And
you can't make
just
players
want it more. You can't understand. Literally, just want it more.
Like, you can't make players like Luka Modric and Toni Kroos run about and trying to win the ball back in midfield. It leaves you too open because they can't do it. So you've got to play in a different way. And then you get so much more benefit about how they play. Like, Barcelona can't play exactly the same way in midfield. Well, maybe it could be Pedri and Gavi, actually. They probably could do that. But but like those players play in a certain way and it works. Like, they've got Liverpool on Tuesday night, so this will come out on Tuesday morning.
Real Madrid, yeah.
Real Madrid. Real Madrid are playing Liverpool. And so you'll see, I'm really interested to see what Ancelotti does, like how he sets them up, how he wants to win the ball back. Will he target Alexander-Arnold on the right? Almost certainly yes, of Vinicius Jr. And then where the overloads come and what he'll do. Because Ancelotti's a brilliant coach as well. Like, tactically, I think he's really good. But he just does things that suit the players he has in a less... like there's a theory that like the good tactical coaches are the ones like Ten Hag or Xavi who do all the fancy new things, right?
It doesn't mean it's like top down, right? Where it's like this is how we're going to play. Here's the ideas. Whereas with Ancelotti, there's famous clips of him talking to the players, being like, "What would you do in this situation?" as well. So it feels a little bit more bottom up with Ancelotti, like he allows the players to solve problems on the field to a degree.
Solving problems. Well, in fairness, Barcelona were something of a laughing stock at this, you know, with all their levers and issues. Whereas now they're coherent on the pitch and they're going to probably win La Liga, so that's good, and that wraps up that bit. I think watch all the football in the week. It will be great. We are done. I think that is enough time of the football talk, so therefore I'll say thank you, JJ.
Thanks.
Thank you, John McKenzie.
Thanks.
Thank you to Steve and Don for their sterling work. Thank you to you, the listener/viewer. Remote viewing tells me Joe Devine will be back hosting next week, probably.
It doesn't let you see in the future. That's not how that works.
Oh
no.
Must have been something else then. Maybe I saw it in a dream.
If you could see through his eyes right now, you'd see where he was. You wouldn't be able to...
Oh my God! No, let's not do that. See you later. Bye!
The Athletic.